Jhumpa Lahiri's Interpreter of Melodies burst onto the literary scene in 1999, captivating readers with its nuanced portrayal of the immigrant experience and winning the prestigious Pulitzer Prize for Fiction in 2000. The collection resonated deeply with both critics and casual readers, selling over 15 million copies worldwide and becoming a staple in college literature courses across America. What makes this collection particularly remarkable is how it transcends cultural boundaries while remaining deeply rooted in the specificity of Indian and Indian American experiences. Former President Barack Obama included it among his recommended books, praising its quiet, devastating power, while celebrities like Mindy Kaling have cited Lahiri as a profound influence on their own creative work. The stories continue to feel startlingly relevant today, offering insights into the universal human experiences of displacement, belonging, and the complex terrain of cross-cultural relationships. In A Temporary Matter, Lahiri masterfully explores how tragedy can simultaneously unite and divide a couple. Shobha and Shukumar's marriage has been slowly disintegrating since the stillbirth of their son 6 months earlier. The scheduled electrical outages in their neighborhood create an unexpected space for vulnerability, a temporary darkness where painful truths can finally emerge. The ritual of confession that develops during their candlelit dinners reveals the small betrayals that have accumulated in their relationship. Shukumar admits to tearing out a magazine photo of another woman during Shobha's pregnancy and exchanging her anniversary gift for cash. Shobha confesses to letting him speak to his department chairman with pate on his chin and admits she never liked his only published poem. These seemingly minor admissions carry the weight of deeper disconnections. What makes this story particularly devastating is how the temporary reconnection, making love with a desperation they had forgotten, ultimately leads to the final revelation. Just as the electrical repairs are completed ahead of schedule, Shobha delivers her own conclusive news. She's moving out. The timing is cruelly ironic. The darkness that allowed them to speak honestly is ending just as the relationship reaches its breaking point. The story's emotional climax arrives when Shukumar reveals the one secret he'd sworn never to tell, that their baby had been a boy, and unlike what Shobha believed, he had arrived at the hospital in time to hold their son before cremation. This knowledge, which Shobha had desperately wanted but believed impossible, becomes the final blow to their relationship. As the lights go out one final time, they weep together for the things they now knew, not just about their lost child, but about the irreparable damage to their marriage. The genius of Lahiri's storytelling lies in how she uses the scheduled power outages as both literal circumstance and perfect metaphor. The temporary darkness creates a liminal space where truth can emerge, but it also represents the temporary nature of their reconnection, a brief flicker before permanent separation. When Mr. Pirzada Came to Dine offers a unique perspective on historical tragedy through the innocent observations of 10-year-old Lilia. Set against the backdrop of the 1971 Bangladesh Liberation War, the story explores how global conflicts can be simultaneously distant yet intimately felt through personal connections. Mr. Pirzada, a botanist studying New England foliage on a Pakistani government grant, visits Lilia's family regularly to watch news broadcasts about the civil war ravaging his homeland. His elegant appearance, wearing a black fez secured with bobby pins, and a fine checkered wool coat that smells of limes, belies his constant anxiety about his wife and 7 daughters back in Dhaka, now Dhaka. The silver pocket watch he carries, meticulously set to Dhaka time, symbolizes his emotional tether to a home 11 time zones away. What makes this story particularly poignant is Lilia's developing awareness of suffering beyond her comfortable American existence. Her nightly ritual with Mr. Pirzada's candies, storing them in her grandmother's sandalwood box and eating them while saying prayers for his family's safety, represents her childlike attempt to participate in a crisis she can barely comprehend. The contrast between her school's exclusive focus on American history and the unfolding humanitarian disaster in East Pakistan highlights the cultural insularity that often characterizes American education. The carved Halloween pumpkin becomes an unexpected symbol when news from DACA causes Mr. Pirzada's hand to slip, creating an accidental expression of placid astonishment on the jack-o'-lantern. This image perfectly captures the surreal juxtaposition of American holiday traditions against the backdrop of international tragedy. Through Lilia's eyes, we experience the strange cognitive dissonance of watching atrocities unfold on television while maintaining the routines of daily life, meals, conversation, games of Scrabble, and music. The story gently suggests that witnessing suffering, even from a distance, creates an ethical responsibility that transcends borders. For Lilia, this responsibility manifests in her small but meaningful acts of remembrance and prayer. The collection's title story, Interpreter of Melodies, explores the profound misunderstandings that can arise between cultures and individuals. Mr. Kapasi, who works as both a tour guide and medical interpreter, finds himself drawn to Mrs. Das, an Indian-American tourist visiting the Konark Sun Temple with her family. Their brief encounter reveals the vast gulf between fantasy and reality in cross-cultural connections. The ancient temple, with its enormous chariot-shaped structure and erotic carvings, provides a richly symbolic backdrop. As Mr. Das photographs the temple and reads mechanically from his guidebook about how the wheels symbolize the cycle of life, we see a family disconnected from both their cultural heritage and each other. The children run ahead unsupervised, Mrs. Das moves with indifferent slowness, and the parents barely interact. Mr. Kapasi's attraction to Mrs. Das is fueled by cultural misconceptions. He fantasizes about their future correspondence, imagining himself as an interpreter between nations, while calculating that her first letter should arrive in about 6 weeks. This fantasy reveals his romantic notion of connection with the America he knows only through television and magazines. The story takes a dramatic turn when Mrs. Das confides that her son Bobby is not her husband's child, but the result of a brief affair with her husband's Punjabi friend. Her 8-year confession reveals both her unhappiness and her fundamental misunderstanding of Mr. Kapasi's role. She hopes he can interpret her pain and offer some remedy, treating her emotional distress like a medical symptom that can be diagnosed and cured. Mr. Kapasi's reaction, asking if what she feels is pain or guilt, reveals his own disillusionment. Insulted that she considers his interpreter skills applicable to her trivial confession, he recognizes the hollowness of their connection. The moment of potential intimacy collapses into mutual disappointment. The story culminates with Bobby wandering off and being attacked by monkeys attracted by the trail of puffed rice falling from Mrs. Doss's bag, a perfect metaphor for the consequences of her carelessness. As Mr. Kapasi hurries after her with a branch to ward off the animals, their brief moment of false understanding dissolves completely. The family photo they attempt to take at the end will capture only the surface appearance of unity, concealing the profound disconnections beneath. In A Real Derwan, Lahiri examines how precarious belonging can be for those living on society's margins. Burima, a 64-year-old refugee from East Bengal, serves as an unofficial doorkeeper in a dilapidated Calcutta apartment building. Her position, like her stories of past wealth, exists in a liminal space between reality and fabrication. The catalyst for Burima's downfall is, ironically, the building's increasing prosperity. After Mr. Dalal's promotion leads him to install 2 basins, one in his flat and another on the stairwell for all residents, the other residents begin their own renovations. This wave of improvement disrupts Burima's routine and place in the building's ecosystem. With workers constantly coming and going, she moves to the rooftop and begins wandering the streets during the day, leaving her post unattended. The theft of both her life savings and the communal basin creates a perfect scapegoat scenario. Despite her protests, "Believe me, I did not inform the robbers," the residents immediately blame her absence from her post, accusing her of colluding with thieves. The ease with which they discard her reveals the conditional nature of her acceptance. Her belongings are thrown into the alley, and she is summarily evicted. Mr. Chatterjee's declaration that what a building like this needs is a realtor one delivers the final blow, suggesting that Borima's years of service count for nothing because she lacks official status. The image of her departing with only her broom, shaking her empty sari, powerfully symbolizes how the marginalized can be stripped of both possessions and identity when they no longer serve a community's needs. The story offers a subtle critique of class consciousness in post-colonial India. As the residents aspire to middle-class respectability, they discard the very person who has maintained their building's dignity through years of decline. Borima's fate illustrates how economic advancement often comes at the expense of compassion, with vulnerability recast as liability. Sexy explores the complex interplay between cultural stereotypes, desire, and moral awakening through the affair between Miranda, a young American woman, and Dev, a married Indian man. Their relationship unfolds against the backdrop of another infidelity story, that of Lakshmi's cousin, whose husband has abandoned her for a younger woman he met on a plane. Miranda's naivete is established early in the story. She knows how to wait for Dev's calls, sitting at her dining table in the evenings, coating her nails with clear polish, eating salad from the bowl, watching television. This image of passive anticipation contrasts sharply with Dev's compartmentalized life, where he can call her late at night with people laughing in the background, guests at his suburban home with his wife. The cultural exoticism that initially attracts Miranda to Dev gradually reveals itself as problematic. When she asks what his wife looks like, Dev says she resembles a Bombay actress named Madhuri Dixit. This comparison sends Miranda to an Indian grocery store that rents videos, where she sees beautiful Indian actresses on the covers and realizes Dev's wife must be beautiful too. Her fascination with Indian culture, buying a silver cocktail dress that reminds her of saris, visiting an Indian grocery store, and purchasing a tourist guide to India, suggests she's romanticizing not just Dev, but an entire culture. The story's moral turning point arrives through 7-year-old Rohan, the son of Lakshmi's devastated cousin. While babysitting him, Miranda experiences a profound shift in perspective. The precocious boy, carrying the emotional weight of his parents' separation, follows Miranda everywhere and engages her with his capitals memorization game and demands for coffee like he had on the airplane. When Rohan discovers Miranda's silver cocktail dress, the one she wears for Dev, he insists she put it on. His innocent definition of sexy as loving someone you don't know cuts to the heart of Miranda's affair with Dev. This child's interpretation, clearly explaining his father's infidelity, forces Miranda to confront the reality of her relationship. The numbness she feels afterward signals her moral awakening, the recognition that she's participating in the same kind of betrayal that has devastated Rohan's family. Mrs. Sens offers one of the collection's most poignant explorations of cultural dislocation through the relationship between 11-year-old Elliot and his after-school caretaker, Mrs. Sen. The story delicately traces the parallels between different forms of abandonment, Mrs. Sen's separation from her extended family in India, and Elliot's emotional neglect by his career-focused mother. Mrs. Sen's apartment exists as a carefully maintained Indian enclave within America. The meticulously clean space with fabric-covered electronics and precisely positioned carpets represents her attempt to recreate home. Her beautiful saris and adherence to Indian customs, removing shoes at the door, preparing elaborate meals, and eating without Western utensils, all reflect her resistance to assimilation. The semicircular blade she uses to chop vegetables becomes a powerful symbol of cultural continuity. Brought from India, this tool connects her to home not just through its origin, but through the practiced motions of using it while seated on newspapers, as she would in India. Her explanation to Elliot,
Whenever there is a wedding in the family or a large celebration of any kind, my mother sends out word in the evening for all the neighborhood women to bring blades just like this one, and then they sit in an enormous circle on the roof of our building, laughing and gossiping and slicing 50 kilos of vegetables through the night. Reveals what she misses most: community, connection, and shared purpose. Mrs. Sen's driving lessons represent her failed attempts at assimilation. Her terror on the road, "Why will not anybody slow down?" contrasts sharply with Elliot's mother's effortless navigation of the same streets. The driving becomes a metaphor for broader cultural adaptation, with Mrs. Sen's inability to master this essential American skill symbolizing her fundamental displacement. Two things bring Mrs. Sen joy: letters from India and fresh whole fish. Both represent authentic connections to home, the aerograms providing literal news of family, while the fish allows her to prepare traditional Bengali dishes. Her passionate reaction to receiving a letter, embracing Elliot, reading it immediately, and calling Mr. Sen to share every word in her native language reveals the depth of her homesickness. The story's climax comes when Mrs. Sen attempts to drive to the fish market alone with Elliot after Mr. Sen refuses to take her. The minor accident that results leads to the end of Elliot's time with Mrs. Sen. The final image, Elliot becoming a latchkey child, telling his mother he's fine while staring at gray waves receding from shore, perfectly captures the emotional abandonment both he and Mrs. Sen experience in different ways. This Blessed House explores the complex tensions that can arise in cross-cultural marriages through the evolving relationship between newlyweds Sanjeev and Twinkle over Christian artifacts discovered in their newly purchased New England home. Their fundamental disagreement about these religious objects reveals deeper differences in their approaches to cultural identity, assimilation, and the nature of marriage itself in an immigrant context. Sanjeev, educated at MIT and holding an executive position, embodies a particular type of Indian American success story. Practical and intensely concerned with appearances, he wants to discard or hide the Christian items, viewing them as inappropriate for a Hindu household. His discomfort stems from multiple sources: worry about what their Indian friends might think, his more rigid sense of cultural boundaries, and perhaps most significantly, his desire to maintain what he considers an appropriate ethnic identity in America. While listening to Mahler's Fifth Symphony, music he considers sophisticated and proper, he mentally catalogs an increasing list of irritations about his new wife: her impractical high heels clicking on hardwood floors, her casual approach to housekeeping, her seemingly childlike excitement about trivial discoveries, and her willingness to embrace aspects of American culture he finds distasteful. Their marriage, arranged by their parents just 4 months earlier, hasn't had time to develop deep emotional roots or established patterns for resolving conflicts. The discovery of a waist-high plaster Virgin Mary statue in their yard brings their differences to a crisis point. While Sanjeev strenuously objects to displaying it before their housewarming party, fearing judgment from their predominantly Indian social circle, Twinkle insists they must keep it visible. Her emotional breakdown during their argument, crying out, "This is our house, we own it together," reveals that the conflict extends far beyond decorative choices. It's fundamentally about having equal say in shaping their shared life and identity as a couple. The compromise they ultimately reach, placing the statue in a recess at the side of the house, visible to visitors but not immediately obvious to passersby, suggests the possibility of finding balance between their different approaches to cultural integration. This resolution hints at the ongoing negotiations required in cross-cultural marriages, where neither complete assimilation nor rigid cultural separation offers a sustainable path forward. Their story illustrates how successful bicultural marriages often require both partners to develop flexibility in their cultural expectations while maintaining respect for each other's boundaries and beliefs. The treatment of Bibi Haldar stands out in the collection for its communal narrative voice and its exploration of how social expectations around marriage and motherhood shape women's lives. The story follows 29-year-old Bibi, whose mysterious ailment has defied all attempts at treatment, from holy water and prayers to consultations with every type of medical practitioner. Bibi's marginal existence, confined to a storage room on the roof of her cousin Haldar's building, keeping inventory for his cosmetics shop in exchange for basic necessities, represents the precarious position of unmarried women in traditional Indian society. Her cousin and his wife treat her as a burden, providing minimal care while exploiting her labor. When their baby falls ill with fever, they blame Bibi and permanently banish her to the storage room, with meals left covered at the top of the stairs. The community's response to this mistreatment, boycotting Haldar's shop and eventually caring for Bibi after the Haldars move away, demonstrates the counterbalance that communal ethics can provide against family neglect. Though Bibi claims to embrace her independence, saying, "The world begins at the bottom of the stairs. Now I am free to discover life as I please," her deteriorating condition reveals the reality of her isolation. The story takes a surprising turn when Bibi is discovered to be 4 months pregnant. Though she won't reveal who fathered her child, and no signs of assault are found, the pregnancy catalyzes a remarkable transformation. Within a month of delivering her son, Bibi has converted the storage room into a proper shop, selling Haldar's leftover inventory and eventually restocking with her profits. The irony that motherhood, traditionally accessible only through marriage, becomes Bibi's path to independence and healing subverts conventional narratives about women's roles. The community's continued support allows her to succeed as both mother and businesswoman, creating an alternative family structure outside traditional boundaries. The final observation, to our astonishment, we soon found Bibi had been cured, suggests that Bibi's ailment was never purely physical, but related to her exclusion from full participation in social life. By becoming a mother and establishing economic independence, she finds a place in the community that had previously been denied to her. The collection's final story, The Third and Final Continent, offers a hopeful perspective on the immigrant experience through the narrator's journey from India to London and finally to America. Beginning in 1964 with just a commerce certificate and merely $10, the narrator traces his gradual adaptation to each new country and culture. His early experiences in London establish patterns of communal living and modest ambitions. Sharing cramped quarters with other penniless Bengali bachelors, cooking communal egg curry meals, and spending weekends watching cricket or socializing with fellow Bengalis, he creates a transitional space between India and full Western immersion. By 1969, with a job offer from MIT's library, the narrator prepares for yet another cultural transition, this time with an arranged wife, Mala, whom he barely knows. His arrival in America coincides with the moon landing, creating a perfect metaphor for his own giant leap into unfamiliar territory. His Spartan existence at the Cambridge YMCA, eating cornflakes with milk for most meals and brewing tea in a thermos to save money, establishes his practical approach to adaptation. The heart of the story develops through his relationship with Mrs. Croft, his 103-year-old landlady, whose rigid routines include demanding he say, "splendid," about the American flag on the moon. Despite the cultural and generational gulf between them, they develop a mutual respect. The narrator's small kindnesses, checking on her safety, sitting with her after she falls asleep, placing rent directly in her hands, reveal his fundamental decency. When Mala arrives 6 weeks later, they remain strangers despite their marriage. The narrator isn't accustomed to the smell of steamed rice, a clean bathroom basin, two toothbrushes side by side, or the fragrance of coconut oil in her hair. Their breakthrough moment comes during a visit to Mrs. Croft, who has broken her hip. When Mrs. Croft declares Mala a perfect lady after examining her, the narrator and Mala share their first genuine smile. This moment marks when the distance between Mala and me began to lessen. The months that follow become their true honeymoon as they explore Boston together, discover where to buy fresh fish and Indian spices, meet other Bengalis, and find pleasure and comfort in each other's arms. Mrs. Croft's validation provides the catalyst for their authentic connection. The story ends with the narrator reflecting on his journey across three continents over nearly 30 years. Now an American citizen with a house, garden, and Harvard-educated son, he still points out Mrs. Croft's street whenever they drive through Cambridge, telling his son, "Here was my first home in America where I lived with a woman who was 103. This connection between past and present, between different generations of immigrants, completes the narrative arc of adaptation and belonging. The final reflection? As ordinary as it appears, there are times when it is beyond my imagination, captures the quiet wonder of the immigrant journey. While the astronaut spent mere hours on the moon, the narrator has built a life in this new world that spans decades. His achievement may be ordinary in historical terms, but the personal transformation it represents remains extraordinary."